Thomas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Jake.
It's my pleasure. There is a multitude of different areas that I would like to talk about with you today over the next 60 minutes. But where I will start is, I confess I haven't finished your book, and I bought it on Kindle. I got about 30% through, and I think one of my children has hidden my Kindle somewhere, so I couldn't finish it, annoyingly. But I'd love to understand, you became an author and you wrote a book. So let's begin there. And basically, why did you write a book?
All right. So I've been in Bitcoin, or more the, let's say, blockchain space for just over a decade. I'm saying blockchain because at the beginning, 10 years ago, we thought that it would be blockchain becoming a big thing. And it turned out that the only proper use case for blockchain was effectively Bitcoin. And so I stayed close to the topic for a while. And a few years ago, when I realized that the level of risk behind Bitcoin had so drastically dropped and the potential of Bitcoin was untouched, if anything, or possibly, if anything, probably even increased over the years, I thought, okay, now is really the time to set aside everything else I'm doing and start focusing exclusively on Bitcoin. I decided to research everything I could on the topic, structured my notes as a book, and since I was already writing regularly for other purposes before, I thought that was the good occasion to finally do something I've been willing to do for a while and become an author.
Awesome.
And fortunately, Springer Nature, you know, the big publishing house, made that happen and decided to endorse my book and publish it. So yeah, I got through the full process of being a published author.
Awesome. Well done. And what's so interesting is, in some ways, it's like a stake in the ground, a moment in time. This is what I think about something. And even just on email, and also now as we begin the conversation, you mentioned that you used to believe that it was a kind of blockchain thing, and now it's very much like an only Bitcoin thing. And you confessed, you said, Jake, there is some, you know, altcoin stuff in the book, and there's one section where you were talking through the potential for Ethereum to be doing something. Why is it that you suddenly realized that actually it's not a blockchain thing, it's a Bitcoin thing?
Well, let's take it a step back. I'm coming from traditional finance. And yes, in order to make the transition from traditional finance to Bitcoin, you need to have a certain level of open-mindedness, you know, and to look at things, you know, being ready to have your mind changed. So I did that, came into Bitcoin, and I didn't want to close the door to other innovation, because if I had missed the Bitcoin innovation the first time, or the first three, four times that I looked into it, it's very much possible that I still have blind spots and that there are other stuff that I'm missing. Now, after spending quite a while looking into this, I came to realize that actually the real innovation is really Bitcoin. It is not anything else. But I didn't want to close the door to that straight away, and to remind, I wanted to remain open-minded about it. Now, as time passes, it becomes increasingly obvious that the only use case for blockchain technology is indeed Bitcoin, because the level of decentralization of Bitcoin is unparalleled. It cannot be mimicked, not by Ethereum or any of the likes. And if a crypto asset is not properly decentralized, well, you can wonder whether it has value in the first place. You know, the whole value behind blockchain technology is to create a decentralization, because otherwise a blockchain is a rather inefficient way of structuring data. At the end of the day, it's just a database, and a rather inefficient one. The only benefit it has is that it enables decentralization. It enables this database to remove any single point of failure, to remove any centralized party to manage it. So the whole point is to have decentralization. As soon as you lose the decentralization, then there's really no point in having a blockchain in the first place. And unfortunately, even though many altcoins come from a, let's say, something positive. They try to achieve something good, but they lose this fundamental piece, which is the incentives for long-term decentralization.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? And well done for keeping an open mind. I think that is absolutely critical to really anything that we do in life. It doesn't just have to be to do with the money that we choose. But what I'm intrigued to then understand is, so when you say you're coming from a traditional finance perspective, I always love these stories because often, and I don't know if it's the same for you, but I was highly trained in how to make money, but I never asked, what is money? So take me through your traditional finance background, like what you studied perhaps, and some of your early career and the skills that you picked up through that process.
Yeah, sure. Well, what you just said resonates quite a bit. That's, I feel like it's our journey for all of us in the traditional finance space, at least with these roots. So I came from a traditional economics background. So two masters in two top universities here in Europe in economics. Then I decided to move to banking and study finance in parallel. I did a few advanced financial certifications while I was making my teeth at ING in their traineeship program in Austria, Germany, and the Netherlands. And after a few years there, trained as a regulatory risk manager and financial risk manager, I decided to go for an MBA. Cool. Then I spent some time in pharma, and just over a year ago, I decided to leave that behind and really focus exclusively on Bitcoin.
So cool. And so when you are trained in financial risk management, can you give me some examples as to what it is you were actually looking at?
Yeah, sure. So I've had the privilege of doing a rotation program and therefore working in many different departments in financial risk management. So going from liquidity risk management, so for a bank, how do you make sure that your assets and liabilities are roughly, let's say, have a similar profile in terms of duration and how quickly your asset can deplete and how well your liabilities would be able to take to absorb that. I've worked in credit risk management, so looking at specific institutions and specific corporates, looking at what is the likelihood that they reimburse any loan that the bank would make to them. If they are not able to reimburse the loan, how high is the exposure to them? How much would you be able to recover in case they couldn't make the loan? I worked in risk analytics, so encompassing all of the different risk management departments of the bank and making sure that it is something that the entire bank can absorb. For example, building recovery plans, restructuration plans, so measuring, mitigating, and tracking the different types of risk that the bank is taking. I've worked in treasury, developed tools to manage intraday liquidity for the treasury department of ING in Germany.
Wow.
Yeah, just
incredible.
Just name it. I've touched all parts of risk management. And then, of course, I specialized the last few years in regulatory risk management, which was, let's say, in the 2014 to 2017, it was the wave after the financial crisis where all regulatory institutions were sending dozens of new regulations every week. I wish that was an exaggeration, but it's not. So it was literally reviewing the number of, the pieces of regulations that were coming through to the banking sector and to other financial institutions. It was literally dozens every week, new things, new rules, new thresholds, new things that the banks had to do. And I was distributing that through the bank and ensuring the implementation of it was done carefully.
So interesting, Thomas. Thank you for sharing some of that. I think from where I'm sitting, it's very clear that you have deep expertise in the financial industry. Like when you sit within a bank and you get moved through all of these different departments, you get a very, very good understanding for how it functions. And what I always find incredibly compelling is when people are like, Bitcoin, 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 such that they quit their job and they write a book and they end up, you know, working for a Bitcoin business. How many of the friends that you picked up in your time working in that kind of space are now interested in Bitcoin in the same way that you are? Or is it still the case that like most of them just, if they believe what you're doing is very risky?
Everybody has a time to make the transition. There is indeed a level of risk with Bitcoin and with making the career transition that should not be ignored. In particular, if you have a very comfortable job in the banking industry, if you decide to make a move like I did to, you know, close that chapter completely and focus exclusively on Bitcoin, well, you will obviously close some doors if you decide to go back, which obviously I have no intention of doing. And not everybody is ready to close these doors, especially after having worked for years in order to
get there.
Open them. Plus, Bitcoin is not something for most people that you just, you know, look at and then you're like, I see the light. This is the way. This is exactly what I need to do. At least in my case, it took many months. It took even years, I have to say, of carefully looking into it, literally studying Bitcoin for hundreds of hours to analyze every type of risk. You know, people had concerns about Bitcoin, and so did I, probably more than anybody else I know. And I went through each of them, and then studying Bitcoin, I realized, well, actually, this concern is irrelevant. You know, this potential problem can no longer happen, and so on. You know, and at some point, I realized that all the possible reasons why Bitcoin could possibly die had completely disappeared. And I realized, well, if I have no concerns anymore, and if the potential is still so absolutely enormous, then there is really no reason to not focus my entire time and energy on it. So you need to get your head around this. So I had the luxury of having, you know, the capacity and the time to go through that process, but not everybody can go through that, let's say, as early as now, especially, and I want to say, especially in the 2010s, honestly, it was not obvious that it would be a Bitcoin-only world. It was not obvious that Bitcoin would succeed so exceptionally well. So, not everybody I used to work with is interested in Bitcoin. I don't think that they have really something against it for the most part. It's just that they just haven't got their head around it yet, which is fine.
It's almost like people aren't looking. I see this often. It's my old podcast was called Bitcoin with Jake, and the entire focus is like, how did you find out about Bitcoin? What were the like four or five things that happened in your life that meant that you saw value in it? And I did like 80 episodes in 2022, 2023 with people in every country you can think of. And it was just an extraordinary way of actually ultimately me building conviction. And similar to writing a book, it's like, these are all my questions. And I've now spoken to 80 people and they're all like, this is a good idea. So in some ways, I don't mind that people aren't looking at Bitcoin. They'll figure it out in their own time. I just think it's so interesting that like, or at least perhaps this is my interpretation of the modern media paints like finance is this like very, very difficult thing to understand. And people who even work within the industry, they understand their specific part of it, but they never take a step back and say, okay, well, actually, hang on, what is money? And so that has just been one of the most powerful questions I've ever asked. So was there a moment, Thomas, that you can think of that you were like, oh, I really must pay more attention to this thing? Some problems that you came across or some articles that you read or a podcast or a friend, or do you have any kind of standout things that you can think back to and say, oh, that was a very important moment for me?
The critical moment for me was probably still happening when I was at the bank and when I was seeing this wave of regulations coming through every week, every few days. We had new, you know, like another 100 pages from the Bank of Internal Settlement telling you how to measure specific risk-weighted asset for specific type of financial products. The next day, you have something else coming from the European Banking Authority telling you, you know, how to measure shadow banking exposure of the bank. And, you know, I'm just naming a few now. It was literally a daily thing that you had new papers and recommendation on how to measure all these stuff. And at some point, I was like, well, this makes absolutely no sense. There's not one person in the world that can stay on top of all this. I remember coming across a study, I believe it was from Deloitte at the time, that had measured how much time it would take if you were to go through all the financial regulation. So just reading the entire text existing on financial regulation, just reading it once. Well, if you were able to read 24 hours a day, they came up with a conclusion it would take you about 7 years just to read once the old financial regulation.
Whoa.
And well, reading it once. And as you may know, these kind of regulations, you know, you sometimes you spend hours on discussing just a couple of lines.
1 point.
No, yes. Yeah, yeah. Just whether one comma should be interpreted as an and or. And I was in meetings with other banks in Germany discussing the interpretation of some text and literally discussing for like over an hour whether a comma was to be interpreted as an and or as an or. You know, and when you see this level of accuracy that is needed for a quantity of text that is ever increasing and that makes absolutely no sense, I thought, you know what, it's a difficult conclusion to make, but we need to take all of that and put it behind and start something anew. There is no way the system will improve for the better. We are well past that point. Like passing the point of possibly improving the system was, you know, when it was just a tiny fraction of the size of the industry where it is now. Now we need to build something anew. And Bitcoin was this, let's say, solution. The possible safe haven saying, you know what, take all of that, you know, all this centralized Orwellian style regulation, put it aside, and you just start with basics. Everybody is entitled to have money. Anybody can receive money from anybody else at any time without needing to have, you know, a proof of identity, without needing to have even access to the internet, without needing anything, regardless of your political affiliations, regardless of the color of your skin, of your religion, or of anything else. And unfortunately, there are many, many people, so literally billions of people that are currently excluded from the financial sector. Some purposefully excluded, so with sanctions and so on. Some that are just too poor or living in areas that are too remote to have access to a bank account or to have access to internet or to have a proof of identity, and therefore who do not have access to basic, let's say, financial needs. And Bitcoin is the solution that solves all that. And I really like this idea of we are all on the same level here. Everybody can use something that should be a public good, you know, money, like proper money that is not controlled by anybody, that is not manipulated by anybody, something that everybody has access to. I really like this idea. So that's how I came into Bitcoin. And then from there, I realized all the other amazing things about Bitcoin that it can bring.
Well, it's a very, very powerful idea, isn't it? Like, all it does is it receives money, sends money, stores money, and it's accessible to anyone that can, you know, connect to the network. And that's actually very simple. What was certainly a big moment for me as well was this idea of sound money and versus inflationary monetary supplies. It's so fascinating that you've just given me that insight about what it was actually like sitting in a compliance department in a bank, where you as a commercial institution working within the frameworks you're given were being made it was becoming harder and harder to actually abide by the own rules of the system. But when you see what the money printer does from an incentive perspective, at least from my perspective, it's inevitable that it gets like that, because they can kind of print their own money, make their own rules, and then, well, oh no, the system's not working anyway, so we better tell everyone that we're going to make some more rules. And the it's that classic kind of intervention thing, isn't it, where it's like, okay, so you intervened in the free market. There was a whole heap of problems you didn't expect to happen. So instead of saying, actually, we're going to just back out and remove our initial intervention, it's like we're going to create more interventions to solve our original problems. And then you end up with 7 years worth of financial compliance to do. That's like no head of compliance could ever read that. It's wild, isn't it? Did you have any insight into what sound money was before you came across Bitcoin?
Not sound money itself, not the concept as we understand it today. There was one class at university that had really resonated with me and that I was looking forward to expand during my career, which never really happened. It was a class that was focusing on the concept of complementary currency.
Cool. I was going to ask.
Actually, the second chapter of my book is on this topic. It's the idea of, instead of having a single currency in an economy, you would have multiple currencies working in parallel. So it sounds completely wild today, but actually that was a topic that was already being fairly investigated in the 90s and in the early 2000s. That was considering having a single currency actually exposes you to a lot more volatility of the financial system, of the banking system, and therefore exposes you to many more crises. So just the IMF, for example, is reporting that they were about 500 different banking crises, debt crises, and monetary crises over the past 50 years or so. So it's like 10 or just above 10 crises that you would have per year in the world. And there is actually extensive literature suggesting that one of the reasons for that is the reliance on a single currency for economies. If you have multiple currencies working in parallel, when one of them tends to, let's say, lose value or be less useful for people, actually the other currencies tend to do well. You have seen that with empirical evidence, for example, in Switzerland. The biggest complementary currency network in the world was called the Wir network. So in German, Wirtschaftsring. So this is a currency that is used by corporates. It's a system of credit and debits that corporates use between each other in order to trade instead of the Swiss francs. So you can choose either using Swiss francs to pay your suppliers, or you could use what is called the Wir network, and therefore be automatically, so instead of waiting 90 days to receive your payment, you could settle it instantly. And you know, when you have a network of many people, it would automatically clear credit and debit for the entire system, and therefore you would be able to be paid faster and enable a higher level of velocity of money. Now, staying aside from the very theoretical things about complementary currencies, the existence of the Wir network in Switzerland is one of the things that would likely explain why Switzerland has been through, let's say, the last 50 years or so, one of the most stable economies in the world, with one of the most stable currencies in the world, despite the fact that it's a relatively small country. You know, it's all things would indicate it should be a relatively irrelevant currency. You just have like 8 or 9 million people living in Switzerland. In the grand scheme of things, this is tiny compared to all big countries. Yet they have a currency that is known worldwide, that is one of the most stable, successful currencies in the world. You have other countries that are, for example, denominating mortgages in Swiss francs because they know that this is a more stable currency than their local currency. They do that, for example, in Poland. And while you cannot identify with 100% certainty that the existence of a complementary currency is what has caused this stability in the first place for Switzerland, this is certainly something that has contributed positively. Now, this is one example. There are others. For example, in Austria, there's a little city called Würgel, where in the aftermath of the Second World War, where every city was very poor for obvious reasons, this city had introduced a complementary currency and became one of the most successful cities in the entire region, just because the level of economic activity within that specific city with this complementary currency was orders of magnitude higher than those of other cities, similar places in the region. So you have empirical evidence, you have theoretical background of why that could be the case, and yet barely anybody has ever heard of complementary currency, because this is something that goes, let's say, against the mainstream finance. Few people know that, but actually when the euro was meant to be introduced, it was not meant to replace national currencies. It was meant to come on top of national currencies. So it was meant that people would still use the Deutsche Mark, the French franc, the Italian lira, and then they would also have euros in their pocket. And then depending on the needs, you would use either euros or your local national currency. It looks like this system would be less able to produce outcomes because, you know, it's not practical to use multiple currencies. Well, it is indeed, let's say, slightly slower, or there are some frictions in having multiple currencies. However, it makes the system more resilient. And this is the whole point of having these multiple currencies. You want the system to be more effective over the short term, but you also want the system to be resilient over the long term. You don't want to have currency crisis or monetary crisis every few years. And complementary currencies would help you to, let's say, tilt the balance towards a more long-term sustainable situation. Bitcoin is actually a form of a complementary currency. Bitcoin is something that you can use in addition, in parallel to what you are currently using for your daily trades. You know, the same way 2000 years ago, people were using gold coins and silver coins, you know, typically silver coins for local exchanges of small value. Gold coins were more standardized and used between different major cities in Europe, with a standard size and weight, and they were recognizable from one country to another. That was also a system of, you know, dual currency. Well, now Bitcoin is bringing that as well. And I believe that Bitcoin will also stabilize the current system just by its mere existence. When people think that your local currency will devalue because, you know, printing is coming, because interest rates are being decreased and so on, well, they will automatically flock to Bitcoin, putting pressure on the traditional currency in such a way that the emitter of this traditional currency knows that if he exaggerates on the money printing, he will devalue the currency very easily, because people have an escape valve and therefore they will control themselves. They will need to self-regulate a little bit better than they would do otherwise. If you know that people have no choice but to use, let's say, the US dollar, well, you can double the quantity of US dollar overnight. People will still use that. If you know that if you do so, if you print, so if you double the quantity of US dollar, people will just stop using it. Well, you will think twice before printing so much, and you will probably self-regulate. And if you really want to print, you will print less than that. So not only is Bitcoin a better system, but it's also making the existing system better by creating a level of competition between two monetary systems. The same way you have companies competing in any industry, making it more attractive for you, for consumers, because they have, you know, they have better prices, better service than in the case of a monopoly. Well, here in the monetary system, you also now have competition making it better for users because they have the choice and they have these monetary systems that are competing with each other and forcing each other to be the best in order to grow and be adopted.
So cool, Thomas. Thank you for taking me through all that. I was trying to remember the two words that from your book. So was it the complementary currency system? It highlights that if you have a single currency, it's very efficient. Mm-hmm. Or is it effective or efficient? I couldn't remember the correct word.
Versus, I think efficient is the right word in English. Yeah.
Efficient versus then
resilient.
This is a really interesting point that you made, because it's like, okay, well, of course you want to be efficient, but at what cost? And if the cost is resilience, well, maybe that's not actually worth the trade-off. The complementary currency insights that you have. So you were studying complementary currency theory in the early 2000s or something. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Correct.
Wow. And so that was just something that you did during your studies and then has now obviously, you know, 10, 20 years later become relevant to what you're doing.
Yes, absolutely. So I was actually, I think 2011 or 2012, I was actually holding speeches in front of a think tank in Brussels on the potential of complementary currencies. I did not even know that Bitcoin existed at the time. But basically what I was praising was already a Bitcoin-like system. So I always like to say that I was a Bitcoiner before even knowing that Bitcoin existed.
Yeah, cool.
But it just shows that, you know, there are many different ways of coming into the Bitcoin space. The problem that Bitcoin solves is very real. It's something that literally makes the entire system fragile, and that we need something to solve it. Now, Bitcoin happened to be the best way of solving it and has testified over the last 16 years to be anti-fragile, to be resistant to censorship, resistant to attacks, to be properly decentralized, which, by the way, were all things that I did not really have on my radar. I didn't have, you know, my head around all of this yet. Nobody did, I believe. And now Bitcoin really seems to be the solution to most of the financial monetary issues that we are facing these days, whether people accept to so admit it or not.
And I also really like this idea of how it's going to, in some ways, stabilize the existing, so the lack of resilience that we see globally in all these different financial problems that pop up all the time. Bitcoin's pure existence as an alternative outside of that system already tempers the behavior of the current problems. Now, it may not be all that obvious because, you know, we're seeing the big, beautiful bill just about to arrive. So the money print is getting switched on and it's going to happen in all sorts of different places on top of the US. But it's a great point because it kind of puts the dampeners on the people that have basically it's shitting on the central banker's party. That's for sure. It's like, sorry, guys, there's now another option. Thomas, if you can, I'm not suggesting that you were specifically at the table at the time, but you mentioned the euro was initially planned as a complementary currency, but then that was changed. Do you have any insights to why that was, like, why did they do that?
Yeah, there's actually one author in particular, Bernard Lietard, who unfortunately is no longer with us. He passed away a decade ago. He was very involved in the development of the euro, and he was one of the most prolific authors on complementary currencies. And he was sharing on some videos that you can still find on YouTube that when he was talking behind the scenes on the system, everybody was telling him, look, don't touch the monetary system. So he first tried through the let's say, the public way of talking, so of pushing for complementary currencies and for how the euro should be implemented. And then after facing so much pushback at the time, late 90s, if I'm not mistaken, then he decided to start doing things privately because he realized that, you know, at the time, the public sector was not gonna embrace innovation and embrace a superior business model. I mean, there are too many entrenched interests. You know, the incumbent system has too much to lose to embrace something better. It sounds obvious. If you have the ability to print the currency, would you like to give up this ability? You know, this is an enormous power that you have. Why would you willingly give up this power? Obviously, the people the incumbent do not want to relinquish this power. You know, the same way taxis did not like when Uber came in, the same way hotels did not like when Airbnb came in. You know, the same way, you know, you can think of many innovations.
Many disruptions, that, yes.
Yeah, exactly. They never liked these disruptions coming over and taking over, doing what they were doing, but just better and in a more appropriate way with the current time. Well, it's the exact same thing here, but with something that is so fundamental. You know, the monetary system is behind everything we're doing. It's behind all economic activity in the world. Well, it was obvious that there would be resistance. It was obvious that the incumbent system would fight back. And we just happen to be now at the stage where we realize that their fight back is not going to make it. You know, they are losing power every day. Bitcoin is increasing in size and influence every day. And now it's about navigating the transition in a smooth way. But you cannot put the genie back in the bottle. There's no way to prevent this transition from happening now. The same way you cannot, you know, stop AI from growing. You cannot stop the internet from being adopted by more people. This is happening whether people like it or not.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on the kind of inevitability of it from my perspective. And that's also come with time and just increased research, increased conversations, increased product market fit, all the different features that are coming out. It's absolutely, yeah, the next 10 years can be fascinating. You may not know the answer to this, Thomas, but why did the European nations that joined the euro relinquish the ability to print their own money? So when the euro itself was taken in, like why would they say, oh, actually, we don't want to print our own Deutsche Marks. We don't want to print the franc. We don't want to print lira. Like, how did they negotiate that?
So I've read a couple of books on the topic. Unfortunately, I don't have, obviously, the final answer. I was not there.
And it's history now, so it doesn't matter. But I don't think
that was really an option. It was more, look, we want to make, in the efforts to make the European Union more unified, and honestly, efforts that date back to just after the Second World War, you know, they wanted to stop having wars every decade or so between Germany and France. That's why the European Union was built in the very first place. They wanted to have a unified country the same way you have the United States of America. They wanted to have the United States of Europe. Mm-hmm. And coming to a common currency fitted that narrative of, guys, we're in the same boat. You know, either we grow together or we perish together. So the narrative of unification was strong. And having a single currency obviously made sense in that narrative. And I don't think that, you know, innovative ideas at the time were considered so seriously, like complementary currencies, it's not something that was done anywhere else, as far as I'm aware. At least not at nation scales or multi-nation states level.
But it makes me think, Thomas, like, I mean, you made another great point about referencing air miles. Look, air miles represent a form of currency and a very specific use case. But I would almost even go as far back as talking about credit itself. And like, oh, you know, I owe you a favor, you owe me a favor. Like that in itself is a form of currency. So to say, oh, there's only one currency that can ever be used, well, that's obviously just not true, because you go through every single day using different types of currency for different things. So I think you made an excellent point there. What I'd like to do now, Thomas, if I may. So like, what are you most excited about working on at the moment?
What I believe is the most important part of the journey right now is to put Bitcoin in the pocket of as many people as possible. You know, there are some of us who were in Bitcoin early. I mean, I say early. I wasn't even in Bitcoin seriously until just 3-4 years ago. So it's not like I bought below 16K or something. But still, I believe we are very early into Bitcoin. And there are countless people who need to have access to Bitcoin. Because, you know, you have, in, for example, in Europe, you have CBDCs coming. You have more and more countries where their currency is collapsing and are going to collapse in ways that will be devastating to the lives of millions upon millions of people. These people need Bitcoin. So I think the most important thing for at the moment is to get Bitcoin in the pocket of as many people as possible. This is what makes me stand up in the morning, and this is what I'm focused on at work every day.
Awesome.
Now, there are plenty of
other ways. How do you do that? Yeah.
How do I do that? Well, at Relay, where I have the privilege of currently acting as Chief Financial Officer and Chief Operating Officer, this is the mission that we have as a company, to empower people to take, you know, to take control of their future by giving them simple, rapid access to Bitcoin and the proper way of doing it. So doing it directly in self-custody.
Awesome.
So in minutes or hours, depending on how fast you go through the onboarding process, you can just send some euros or some Swiss francs, get Bitcoin in your self-custody. You know, you see exactly your seed phrase that obviously only you can have. Even we at Relay do not have access to your fund. We do not have access to your seed phrase. They are genuinely yours. And we do that in a way that is as simple and frictionless as possible. I think that this is genuinely the thing that people need the most at the moment. Now, it is not to discard any of the other innovations that are happening in the Bitcoin space. There are countless other things that are being done that are obviously strengthening the value of Bitcoin, the decentralization of the network, the value of the network in many different ways, going from, you know, mining to credit to Lightning Network, other layer twos, and, you know, there are plenty of things that are being done that are fantastic and that I'm very keen on looking into. However, what we need right now, what people need right now, is to have their first Bitcoin in their pocket, to test it, see that it's so straightforward to actually hold your private keys. It's so straightforward to send money to your friend without needing to wait for 3 days to be validated by your bank, without needing to prove where you have the money from, without needing to answer 100 different questions on everything about yourself or your funds. So in a genuinely self-sovereign way, this is what people need, and this is what we are working on relentlessly.
Awesome. Yeah, the Bitcoin is permissionless money, and it's not something that's all that obvious, especially. So I grew up in the UK, you know, being born into a world where, you know, a credit card is not impossible to get hold of. People have mortgages. It's very simple to get a bank account. You already touched on, you know, earlier in the conversation about how many people don't even have bank accounts globally. Like, it's an absolutely extraordinarily large amount of people that are completely excluded from the existing financial system. And so when you really understand that actually you can send Bitcoin whenever you want, you can store it for however long you want, and you can receive it from whoever you want. And it's like, oh my God, this thing's like a superpower compared to what you previously might have to do. And my personal experience of buying Bitcoin, it's quite a treacherous process. It's like, okay, so initially you're going to buy $10 worth or whatever the case might be. You get some skin in the game. That might be the first bit of Bitcoin that people own, and they might sell it to their friend for, you know, a little gain, or they might make a horrible loss and get rid of it. But that is like the first step into the process. And then before you know it, if you're like myself, or, you know, I'm hearing it from you too, Thomas, you get the bug and you start learning more and more and more and more. And so it's like, well, hang on, what do I own? Well, I own all this stuff over here that's not growing in the same purchasing power as Bitcoin, and it's not permissionless. There's counterparty risk everywhere. that previously just kind of ignored, or not ignored, it just wasn't relevant because Bitcoin shines a light on it, right? Oh, these people who will have a portfolio of investment properties, they'll be like, I'm so wealthy. You're like, well, what happens if they all get taken off you? You know, you can't self-custody a house, even though you might think you already are. And so that, yeah, I love that. As self-sovereign as possible is really important. Julian, I believe, is the founder. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard Julian on some content in the past. So how did you guys meet? And what's it like on the inside of a Bitcoin business like Relay?
Just over a year ago, I was chatting with friends in the Bitcoin space on the fact that, you know, I was just at a point that was very uncomfortable, that I had a strong traditional finance background where nobody was interested into Bitcoin. And I was a hardcore Bitcoiner where barely anybody values the fact that you have a strong traditional finance background.
Yeah. It's like, who cares, mate? Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. It's like, oh, fiat credentials. I'm like, yeah, fair enough. You know, I cannot really disagree with that. Yeah, those are fiat credentials. You only look at part of the picture. Nevertheless, it was just at a time where the previous CFO of Relay left for another opportunity, and the position was open. And then this friend of mine working at Relay was like, oh, would you like me to introduce you to Julian, who had been looking already for a CFO for a little bit? And I was like, hell yeah. And nice. We met, you know, first interview, 15 minutes. As is the case in startups, you know, you make it in the first 15 minutes or you're out. And we clicked immediately. So cool. It really went well. And then it was just about negotiating the terms. And a few weeks later, I was starting at Relay.
Really
best decision
cool.
I ever made. And have never looked back. And Relay is a fantastic company. Like, real Bitcoiners in it, real mission. Love it.
Yeah, it's cool to speak to someone like yourself who's with Relay, because it's a brand that I've seen a lot, but I've not actually ever spoken to someone that was part of it, if that makes sense. And I've used British crypto exchanges or Bitcoin exchanges in the past. I haven't ever had to use euros or anything. So I haven't had a need for a Relay account, just from my personal background. And so no need to reveal like anything sensitive in terms of data, but like, are you guys growing very fast as a business? Who are the kind of target customer? And like, I'd love to know a bit about, like, you know, how you're getting on growing the business.
Yeah. Well, interestingly enough, I was also surprised when I came in. I checked the financial statements over the last few years, and I saw that systematically every year of the past 4 years, Relay has been between doubling and tripling its size for all relevant metrics. So users or volume or revenue. So between doubling and tripling every year systematically for 4 years. So that's the pace of growth that we are going through, which is, you know, unheard of in traditional finance. And I do expect this pace to continue in the future. The year 2025 is a little bit more challenging. We are currently applying for a MiCA license. So this is the big regulation in Europe for all crypto asset provider. And therefore we are growing, but we are not growing as fast as in the past because we are not allowed to make any marketing in the European Union since the 30th of December, 2024, since this MiCA regulation came into force. We are on a very, very good track to have it fairly soon. And from there on, I expect our level of growth to resume. I mean, I believe we have a great product. We have great backing from top VC investors that are all Bitcoin only, that believe in us, that, you know, they give us excellent advice. We have a team that is highly skilled, in every department. And, I believe the future for Relay and for the Bitcoin industry in general is absolutely brilliant. So. Looking forward to continue surfing that wave.
Yeah, awesome, Thomas. And let's be honest, if anyone has the requisite skills to negotiate some kind of regulatory hurdle for the business, it should be yourself after the years of working in those jobs that you mentioned before. So no pressure, I'm sure, from your colleagues. It's like, come on, we got to get this over the line. What I don't understand, though, Thomas, is so can you teach me a bit more about the specifics of that regulation? So it's the kind of thing like entrepreneurial exploits. You have to function within the playing field that exists at the day, even if you don't agree with it necessarily or you're out of business. So that was a new regulation that came in at the end of last year. And what was the very high level restriction they put in place with it?
So it is a regulation that is very encompassing in the sense that they will cover everything from liquidity providers to stablecoin issuers to shitcoin issuers to everything, to even exchanges or to relatively small brokers in the Bitcoin space. In addition, there is interpretation of the text that diverges depending on whom you ask. Ask two different people about how to interpret a single sentence of the text and you will get three different opinions.
Wow.
And, and despite all this, you know, you have countless policies and rules to apply to. Many of them come from a good place. They are intended to provide a high level of transparency to users, to provide some kind of safety to users. Unfortunately, so many of these parts of the text are just flawed in their thinking, you know, and end up over regulating small issuers and prevent innovation from growing. Let's be honest, in order to comply with the MiCA regulation, you need to have such a strong compliance team, legal team, AML, CFT setup behind that no small player can afford to go through that. You need to be a big bank, a big exchange, or to be extremely well funded, as we have the luxury of being at Relay, to be able to even have a chance of going through this process, which unfortunately will just strengthen the position of the big players, will prevent innovation from coming up, and will probably make the entire situation worse. And those who will suffer the most from it, in my opinion, are precisely the users, because they will, instead of facing a perfect competition in terms of providers of all these services, they will need to have only a few different places to go to, therefore lower level of competition, therefore, you know, higher margins for these companies. You know, that's basic traditional economics, and low level of innovation, obviously. Plus, it's making the entire system inefficient. And I'm not even talking about all the excessive AML, CFT requirements, you know, all the know your customer and everything. We are required to ask so much more information about customers than what would make sense for us to do our business. We are required to do that, to invade their privacy in a way that is honestly shameful for, you know, just people who are trying to send 50 euros every week because they're trying to save a little bit of their money into Bitcoin. And all this under the pretense of, oh, it's to prevent money laundering and the financing of terrorism. Well, you know what? If somebody is trying to launder money or to finance terrorism, well, they're not going to go through Relay. And whatever system that you have in place, well, that's not going to prevent them because they will find another way outside of Relay and outside of the traditional finance system to do what they want to do. So it's not achieving the point that it's meant to achieve, and it's just putting an enormous burden on just everyday users, on people that are not trying to break the system or to launder money or finance terrorism or any other things like this. So it's unfortunately a big, giant piece of regulation that is that has very negative consequences for the industry and especially for users.
And is it a case of like, okay, they bring the regulation in back in December, I think you said last year, you have to have then got all of your paperwork done by the end of this year? Is there like a timeline for it, or are you immediately you have to close the doors to your customers. How does it work when the regulation is put out?
There is a deadline which is fixed at the end of June 2026.
Okay.
Fortunately, we will have most likely, I cannot say that with certainty, but it's highly likely that we will have our MiCA license well before that. We are obviously in contact with the regulators currently in France, and we have received extremely positive signals on the status of our application. So now it looks to me like it's just a matter of, you know, getting a few more documents through, polish the edges, iron out a few things, and then it will go through. So we're talking now in matter, it's a question of weeks or months, not years. And once we have that, then we can resume doing marketing in the country in which we apply to for us France, and then we need to passport that license into other countries, which we will do, obviously, to be able to inform users across Europe about the benefits of Bitcoin, the benefits of self-custody, and of everything that Bitcoin can bring them.
Awesome. And that's where I think that having people at the top of a business that are building it because they really believe in the underlying mechanics of Bitcoin itself makes such a big difference. You may not want to jump through these hoops from a regulatory perspective, but if you don't, then these products aren't going to be in the hands of people that mm-hmm. enable them to self-custody Bitcoin. So yes, it might be burdensome. Yes, it might be expensive. Yes, there might be some invasive documentation that's required. But it's like, if the bigger picture is, well, Bitcoin has to win, then you just do it. And that's cool. That's really shining through, Thomas. Well, listen, 60 minutes has flown by. Thank you so much for your time today. And in particular, waking up very, very early, whereas I've done this on the Pacific time over in Mexico. So thank you very much for your time. And I hope you have a wonderful day. If anyone wants to reach out and get in touch, Thomas, what's the best way to do that?
So with Relay, just type relay.app. And with me personally, reach out on X or Tin or Noster. Cool. Happy to hear from other Bitcoiners.
Always. Thank you. We'll get those links in the show notes as well. Thomas, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.